Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Detroit Lions Breakdown Podcast. I'm Joe Cania. With me, as always, is Eric Schlitt from USA Today Lions Wire, its official Lions podcast of USA Today Lions Wire. Eric, he's feeling better. You are. Yeah. I am feeling worse. This is what happens when you share a microphone. So we're going to dig right in. Not a whole lot of news going on right now. You have some interesting takes.
Yeah.
They're not even takes. From Taste of the Lions, a little the fancy soiree they had down at Ford Field the other day. We'll get to that in a minute. First things first, the Lions signed five more rookies. I believe that just leaves one that's unsigned.
Will Harris is the only unsigned third-round pick, safety out of Boston College. There's some language in the first-round contracts, and then there's some apparent language in the third-round contracts. Not exactly 100% sure what it is, but if you remember, it caused a delay in Kenny Galladay's contract a couple years back, and apparently it's a little bit of a sticking point right now, but it's going to happen. He's going to get signed. You know, it's just a matter of time.
He's going to play football this year.
Yeah, the rest of the rookies. The rest of the rookies all got signed. All the day three guys are now under contract, with Oruwariye was the only one that had signed at the time of our last show. And so the rest of the day three guys all check in, and 89 of the 90 guys signed.
All right. Moving on, the rookies had their numbers assigned. One surprising one.
Yeah, you know, so ahead of, ahead of the rookie minicamp last weekend.
They have to have numbers on.
Yep. And so they announced that they had signed a few players. They announced the undrafted free agents. They assigned the rookie numbers to the drafted players, and then they went through rookie minicamp, and then they made a couple roster changes after rookie minicamp as well. So the numbers, I know this is one of these things, like schedule releases and number releases. People really get into this, and so I figured it was worth mentioning here, talking about which guys have which numbers. So I thought we'd check them out and see if any of them jump off the page for you.
Well, yeah, first of all, TJ Hockenson wearing Charlie Sanders is number 88.
Yeah, that's a big one, right? For those of you who are younger and don't remember Charlie Sanders, basically, he played with the Lions for 10 years.
He was the best Sanders on this team before Barry Sanders.
Yep. He made seven Pro Bowls, was All-Pro three times. He was All-Decade, part of the All-Decade team. He was the starting tight end on the Lions All 75 team when they were on their 75th anniversary. He's in the Hall of Fame, and he is largely credited as being the receiver who caused a shift in the NFL from the tight ends being blocking to pass catchers. He was the guy who really made the shift happen. And when you change a game like that, I mean, he changed how the NFL was played at his position. And when you do that, it lands you in the Hall of Fame. And he did that for a decade. So he gets his number retired. His number is in the Ring of Honor, the Pride of the Lions Ring of Honor at Ford Field. And Hockenson was number 38 in college. So he said, what are my options? They gave him, he had a few options. 88 was one of them. He picked that. They explained to him what the responsibilities were that go along with that. And he said he was willing to take it on, and away we go. So, you know, the Lions don't really retire numbers. They don't really have anybody's numbers who's retired, but they have a few numbers that have kind of been off limits.
Out of circulation.
Yeah. But no one's ever really been retired. If you remember, the last person to wear 88 was Mike Williams, right? And so it's been worn.
What an error.
Right? And I think it was worn by like three other guys after Mike Williams, prior to Charlie Sanders retiring. And so, you know, it's been used. So it's not out of the norm for that number to come out. But tight end, getting a tight end, a Hall of Fame tight end's number, there's a lot of responsibility that comes with that. And not just on the field, off the field. He was a very good man off the field as well.
Yeah, look at that. More pressure they're foisting upon him.
Well,
we'll see how he can handle it.
He was at the podium on Tuesday, and he talked about how it was a great honor, and he was willing to represent the Charlie Sanders legacy.
Well, I don't know, nothing too shocking here. Austin Bryant gets Luther Ellis's old number. Travis Fulgham gets Herman Moore's old number.
The only receiver on the roster, other than the undrafted free agents, that has a number, a wide receiver that has a number in the 80s. Yep, the only one.
High honor.
Well, I mean, everyone, all the other receivers are in the teens. It's crazy. Well,
when you run out of numbers in the teens, you right? wear a number in the 80s. All right. After rookie minicamp, the Lions made a bunch of roster adjustments, a couple of signings, a couple of releases.
Yeah, so they had signed linebacker Trey Williams earlier in the offseason. He was a big hitter out of Auburn in the 2018 class, but he had some bad shoulder injuries, and those really limited him. He really couldn't stick around as a rookie, and the Lions were willing to give him a shot, but he couldn't make it out of rookie minicamp, and he ended up losing his position. They signed Juwan Young out of Marshall via Miami. Now, Juwan Young was a Mike linebacker at Miami. Marshall moved him to the outside and as a pass rushing linebacker. Then they moved him to defensive end. And he played both like that kind of, he was standing up and rushing.
He's a Jack linebacker.
So he's essentially like a Jack linebacker for the Lions. But he does have some Mike linebacker experience. So he's kind of like a Malik Kearney, the undrafted guy out of North Carolina, where he can do some off-the-ball stuff, but he's mostly going to be like a pass rusher who likes to live in the box, will kind of fit into that Jack linebacker role, in my opinion. He's a guy they visited at Marshall's Pro Day. Should be interesting. He's going to have a big depth chart in front of him, no matter which position you really end up playing him at.
All right, Jordan Smallwood was brought in.
Yeah, he played at Oklahoma in 2018. He's a big receiver, like 6'2", 220, maybe 6'3", 220. But he was on Baker Mayfield's team at Oklahoma. But he wasn't used a whole lot. He was more of like a gadget guy. He scored a couple touchdowns on like end-arounds. So he kind of is in that, not quite an outside speedy wide receiver. He's not a vertical stretcher, but he's kind of like a big, like a small tight end, but a big wide receiver. So it's, again, another long battle for him.
Also signs Tom Kennedy, a slot wide receiver.
Interesting thing about Tom Kennedy is he was a dual sport athlete in college. He played lacrosse. He was actually so good at lacrosse that he was drafted by the lacrosse national team.
Major League Lacrosse.
Yes. And so he last summer he played professionally lacrosse for one summer, came back, played his senior year in football, and then got a tryout with the Lions and was good enough to earn a spot on the 90-man roster going into training camp.
He's a regular Jim Brown. All right. So to make room for those two wide receivers, they booted out two tight ends.
Yeah, Donald Parham and Nate Becker. Nate Becker, we talked about him being a good blocker, so it's not overly surprising, because he was kind of at the end of a long tight end list. Parham, though, was the really unique guy. 6'8", really long.
Yeah, you were excited about him.
Yeah, but he does, I think Smallwood kind of, him and Smallwood were probably in a competition as these guys that were more wide receiver than tight end, and you know, kind of in that F role, that F tight end role. And it'll be interesting to see what they do with Smallwood. But Parham, look, he couldn't make it out of rookie minicamp. So,
all right, Golden Delicious asks a question. Any insight into why Donald Parham was released so soon? Just too many tight ends on the roster. Well, might not be a tight end thing.
Yeah, I think, yeah, part of it is there's more tight ends. But look, if you get an opportunity to come in and you can't make it out of rookie minicamp, that means you did not impress enough, right? And so if you don't, if you can't make it out of rookie minicamp, then that's a problem. And so he probably is not as, they didn't think he was as hyped up, I guess, as, you know, some of the national draft analysts. I think he's talented enough to probably catch on somewhere else because, you know, a lot of 6'8", you know, tight ends that can be wide receivers, those guys aren't often, you know, hanging around in the NFL. So he'll probably get another shot somewhere, but it won't be with the Lions.
All right, Tyler Davis asks, what are your thoughts of Tom Kennedy, the former pro lacrosse player? We signed out of rookie camp. You kind of already addressed that. Mm-hmm. He also tags on to that. Also, thoughts on Bo Benschowl in the right guard competition? Thanks. He'll take his answer off the air. That's basically how that reads when he puts thanks at the end.
So Kennedy is, he looks like a slot guy. He was a guy that they utilized as an outside receiver, but they also used him in the slot. They used him as like an H-back. They used him on end rounds. They used him a lot of different ways because he was such a good athlete at his school. And so it'd be interesting to see what happens with him. There's, you know, when you watch his film, he looks like that typical New England Patriot white slot receiver that you see so often, right? And like, you know, so he's going to get comps to other guys that fit into that same role, like the Amendolas and the, I think that's unfair though, right? I mean, I think that's sure. that's
he's got to be Tom Kennedy. It's not right. going to be Danny Amendola.
Exactly. I mean, too often we end up like associating these guys based on these things, and I don't know enough about him other than the highlights that I watched, right? And so I can't really say, does he have the potential to be this guy? Who knows? I mean, if he's talented enough to get drafted in the lacrosse league and play professional lacrosse, then he has some athleticism, obviously. And so will he be the next Amendola or Endelman? I think that's far too early to even say stuff like that, even though people want to make that connection.
All right, James Schobert asks.
I didn't address the Benschowl thing, but I think I can do it in the
well,
next one.
Well, okay, we'll tag on that question.
Okay.
Why was Benschowl not drafted as the number one rated run blocker in college football per Pro Football Focus? Lack of athleticism alone doesn't explain why this Wisconsin stud did not get attention in the draft. So now you can answer both of those questions at once.
I mean, that stuff happens sometimes, right? You know, the board doesn't fall a certain way. There were, I think, like...
Everybody passed on him seven times.
Yeah, there were like 18 guards in that range that got drafted, right? So wasn't a ton of interior guys getting drafted. Like other positions had a lot more guys drafted, but just being good at like one thing is good enough to get you into a camp, but you have to be able to do more things. And limited athleticism does hurt, especially when you run a zone scheme, like a lot of the NFL does. And so he's going to have that working against him with the Lions, that limited athleticism. But as we've talked about in the past, he is a good technician. But is that enough to overcome his stiffness? He was at the Senior Bowl. Was it Senior Bowl or East-West Shrine? I'm blanking on which one, right? And so he was... When he was at that All-Star game, he didn't show out very well, and there was a lot of chances for him to, like, you know, put on a good impression and give himself a better stock, but it just wasn't enough to really earn him. You know, I think he was draftable. Most people thought he was draftable, but I don't think it's just one of these situations where it just doesn't fit together at the right spot. I get that being the number one rated run blocker per PFF is good and it warrants attention. And that's why, what, there was like 20 or 25 teams that were interested in him post-draft. But, you know, you have to be able to do more. And if he's a good run blocker, that's great. But if you can't trust him as a pass blocker, I don't know if he's going to earn a spot.
Yeah, you changed up your whole sheet here.
I did.
Does it say what post-season bowls they played in?
Yeah, I had to look at an old sheet to figure that
yeah,
out.
Yeah, no, the listeners are going to be very disappointed in you. All right. Brad Rollins asks, with Leo Koloa-Matangi and two undrafted free agent right guards added, why are we still high on Kenny Wiggins? Because he's the incumbent.
Correct.
He's played.
Right. So Koloa-Matangi is a center. I know he has a little bit of guard experience, but he doesn't really have the functional. His big hang up has always been he doesn't have the functional strength to stick at guard. But he's a good center. He's a good backup center. And if Glasgow was your only center, then Leo would probably be on this roster. But Ragnow can play center, Dahl can play center, and that makes things harder for Cole Matangi to find a permanent spot. Again, like Benchwall, if you can only do one thing, it limits your impactfulness. And right now, Leo is a good center, but that's his limitation. We just talked about how Benchwall is a good guard and a good run blocker, but can he do more? That's the big question. The other right guard that was unsigned was Micah St. Andrew. I don't know if he hangs around. I don't know how long he hangs around in training camp. You know what I mean? Like, I don't think he's any competition. Now, Brad didn't mention Ode Abuche, who I think is really a good competition for Kenny Wiggins. But, you know, they've talked this offseason. There's been four offensive linemen that have gone up to the podium this offseason, and all four of them have talked about the chemistry between the offensive linemen in the room. And then when you look at their, like, social media feeds, you see them, Wiggins and Wagner and Frank Ragnow out on a boat fishing. You know what I mean? Like, these guys, they get along, and they talk about how getting along off the field helps them get along on the field, and hopefully that will lead into results. But, you know, like Joe, like you said, he's the incumbent. So in my mind, he gets that start. And all the other stuff, all those other intangibles, makes me think he's going to be the guy. Wiggins is the guy that comes in and starts day one of camp. Now, will they shift Crosby inside? If they do, he'll challenge. Will Abuche challenge? Sure. Will Benchwall do it? Maybe, if he can show that he has something. But there's right now, Wiggins is the guy.
Who's the only one that hasn't spoke to the media? Wagner? Okay. Yeah. All right. Moving on to the Rod Woodshed. Woodsy, which is... I overmodulated there. Woodsy, very appropriate to be asking a question that fits into the Rod Woodshed. Rod Wood mentioned it's a priority for the Lions to repair the relationship with Calvin Johnson before his Hall of Fame introduction. What's your take on why the relationship soured, and how do they go about fixing it? Similar retirement parallel to Barry.
Well, sure. I mean, like, he's a guy who
had to pay money back.
And he retired when it looked like he still had something left. He was the pinnacle of his position in the NFL at the time of his retirement. So, like, there's a whole bunch of these parallels, right? And so the relationship soured because they asked for a portion of his signing bonus back.
Just like they did with Barry.
Correct. And while I can kind of understand that from a team perspective because they overpaid for him at the time, I still think that was kind of a rough ask.
That's what they do.
Yeah. And that's why the relationship soured. Now, you saw him talk to the media last summer about there being a strenuous relationship between him and the Lions. And then you saw him go to, like, the Raiders training camp, right? But he was in the Ford family suite for Monday Night Football against the Jets, the first game of the season last season. So
bad luck charm.
It's possible that the relationship is on the mend, but I don't know. You know, he's trying to grow a business here, no pun intended, with his medicinal marijuana, right? Yep. And he is doing that in Michigan, not somewhere else. You know, he's from Georgia, right? So it's possible that they're working towards a relationship. If they're going to do it before his Hall of Fame induction, they've got 2 years to get this done. And Rod Wood seems very motivated. It's probably going to take, I don't know, they're going to have to, like, apologize to him, and then they're going to have to find a way to get him that money back one way or another.
I don't know if that's going to happen.
But I think they can do it in a different manner. Now, the reason that they took the money back was from a salary cap standpoint. They were able to take that money and put it towards a salary cap by taking that bonus back. That was a salary cap move. What they can do, though, is now that he's retired, they can pay him like a liaison, like they do with Barry, and make him a team ambassador.
Yeah,
and
mascot. Human mascot.
They can give him $1 million to be the team ambassador. He effectively gets that money back. And they can then promote him, and they can talk about how great he is, and they can, and he has to do a few things for the team, but then the team, like, this can be this relationship can be mended, but they're gonna probably have to get him money in one way or another, and I don't think that'll be an obstacle now that people have kind of stepped back and tempers have cooled.
The Lions had every right to take his money. Calvin Johnson had every right to be mad about it. Time heals all wounds, and money will make it go faster. So moving on.
Yep.
Denver Lion asks, thoughts on Wood's comments about potentially hosting the draft? Then use question mark. Will Bill Ford Jr. have the train station done by then?
Man, who knows about that train, right? I don't know. I think that would help. I think if they had more venues, a growing city economy, that will definitely help. Rod Wood said there is a plan that they have where they can, if they were going to host it, this is what they would want to do. They have a plan in place. So
after they saw what happened in Nashville, they have to tear it up and start all over again.
Well, that's the problem, is they said they couldn't match what Nashville did They don't have the landscape for it.
Broadway's right? An incredible street.
Right. And so... they'd have, like, if they did that, like, at Hart Plaza, though, they could hold it at Hart Plaza, I bet. They'd still have to find ways to, like, they'd end up shutting
down. Food and libations.
There's a lot of things that would have to be done. But, you know, it's possible. The thing is it's such a money generator, and it would be such a good thing for the city, and it would generate just so much. It's not like some of these other events. Like, you look at the Olympics. Like, the Olympics kills cities, right? This is one of these things that stimulates and builds. And so, he has been trying to get this.
It does. It really does.
Sure.
No different. It's different than the Olympics mm-hmm. in that respect.
It's like the Super Bowl. You know what I mean? Like, there's a rejuvenation. There's job creation. There's all kinds of things that happen with this type of event. And so, you don't have to... Like, you're not building a whole new stadium like in the Olympics, you know what I mean? Like you're
several venues.
Well, but you have to do some things, but a lot of it is tied into like just cleaning up things that are already there, and so there's a lot of benefits that can come through it, but there's still things that need to be done. If they could earn a spot, that would be great. But you know, it's going to be tough for any Midwestern city to try and grab the draft just because of the time of the year and all these other factors that go into it.
All right. Matt asks, best food at Taste of the Lions. Did you actually taste lions? Even though I did ask you, I told you to enjoy eating lions.
I did not actually have lion, but I had some of the other delicacies that were there. I had a list of the restaurants, and I left it away from us right now, so I can't say this one was great and this one and that one's great.
This is terrible.
Yeah, it's my fault. I am unprepared.
What did you like? You had to eat something you had to like, son.
Yeah, so there was this Novi. I think it was just called the Novi Grill. They had some barbecue. They did ribs, and the ribs, I mean... When you say like it just pulls off the bone, like this literally just pulled right off the bone. Like it was very well done. I pointed people in the direction of them. They did a nice job. I stopped by Hopcat, who had their crack fries, and
I don't think they're called that anymore.
Crack fries? Oh no, really?
Yeah, because I thought that calling them crack fries was inappropriate.
Oh okay, well that's still how I know them.
Sure.
That's what they had. Those were good. I had some other different barbecue places here and there. I tried some Chick-fil-A.
The chicken nuggets.
Yeah, I can see the appeal of those. And I'm not quite on a Kerryon Johnson level of love with it, but I thought it was really good. It was the first thing I had. Bundt cakes, nothing but Bundt cakes.
Nothing Bundt cakes.
Was fantastic.
I've had a nothing Bundt cake before. which was procured by your young daughter for me.
That's true. I forgot. Valentine's Day she got you.
Yeah, yeah, it was very nice of her.
Yes, she's very kind-hearted, so. Marvin Jones was, of course, next to it. And that was really, like, the real fun part about this was you get to talk to these players in an informal fashion, and you're not trying to press them for information about football, and you're just talking to them, and it's a lot of fun. If you paid for the VIP access, like some other people did, I as the media, I wasn't privy to that part of the atmosphere, but you got to meet special players like Matt Stafford and Trey Flowers and Bob Quinn and Patricia, the Fords. They got to meet Martha Ford, and so there was a unique, even more unique experience for them. But the general admission was fun in itself. It's pretty cool because all the money goes to the Eastern Market down there, right? It's all charity-based going to them. They gave us access to Deshaun Hand and Rod Wood. And obviously we talked about these questions from Rod Wood here. Hand was a lot of fun. He was very excited. He's a foodie. And so he's going to end up like emceeing this thing by the time the thing's over. I mean, his career's over. He was very, very much into it. He was having a grand old time, and he had a lot of fun. It was nice touching base back with him again. Him and I had built a nice relationship with him over the last season, and so it was good to see him. And there was just a lot of really cool things. You know, you pass people that you know from online. You meet people that you talk to on Twitter. You run into like Dan Miller, who's just walking around. Torrey Petrie's walking around, and if you're not gonna, so there's just a lot of really cool like opportunities to meet people that you either see as part of the Lions community or interact with, and it's fun. If you can afford it, it's worth it. I think it's a fun event.
All right, debating time. This is a question, more like a soliloquy.
It was a question, and then he wanted to give his input on the answer.
It's from Keen Observations, a longtime writer. With all the recent comparisons of drafting Hockenson and Ebron, I was curious if you think Mayhew is unfairly maligned for that pick. Ebron was drafted to be a move tight end, and the coaches deployed him as an inline tight end the bulk of his Detroit career. That's not Mayhew's fault that he was misused. OBJ and Donald are the players the Lions most criticized for passing on, but OBJ has attitude issues that may have reminded the Lions of Titus Young.
Sure.
Sue and Fairley were on the roster, and at least one was expected to re-sign. Luan was the cap guy, not Mayhew. Botching the Sue negotiations was on Luan. So many slammed Mayhew for the Ebron pick. Sure, some better players were drafted afterwards, but Ebron is a good player. I think he was misused, and the cap issues were on Luan, not Mayhew. What are your thoughts?
So I want to get your thoughts on this too, but there's parts of that I agree with and parts of that I don't agree with. I absolutely agree with the fact that I think he was misused during part of his career. I absolutely agree that Lawan's mismanagement of the cap was detrimental in a lot of ways. It really hindered the Sue negotiations. You know, they thought that they were going to be able to hang on to Sue and Fairley, which, you know, was one of the reasons why Donald was not as appealing to them as getting an offensive weapon. I do hold Mayhew responsible for a lot of this, though, because I know he's drafting a player, but he has to also draft a player that his coaches will know how to use properly. Like, you can't separate him in this fact. Like, yes, you can say he's the guy who's bringing the ingredients to the table, but he also has to know what the cook wants to do with those ingredients. And so I do hold him responsible, just like I hold Bob Quinn responsible for drafting players for Jim Caldwell, even though some of those guys didn't work out. I think because he didn't exactly know how to do that properly. And so, but there's still some culpability that goes with Quinn there. So, yeah, I think Mayhew needed to, I thought that's the pick he was going to make. I liked the pick at the time. I do think he was mismanaged. But I do also hold Mayhew responsible for, you know, taking a position that maybe they didn't need, or maybe they did need, if, you know, there were other offensive playmakers they could have gone after. I understood the pick, but I do think, you know, it's a collective. There's enough blame to go around to all of these people, and I think Mayhew is responsible for some of that.
Yeah, I agree with your thoughts on Mayhew. You know, he was misused. Ebron was misused, but Mayhew's picking, with keeping in mind that how his coaches are going to use these players that he's picking for them.
Right.
I do agree with Keen when it comes to the OBJ situation. If we would have drafted OBJ, it probably would have been a big problem here. You know, guys who have attitude issues usually get exacerbated. Not so much with this new regime, but traditionally, you know, this isn't considered the strongest hardline front office franchise out there that to deal with these things. I don't agree by saying that Luan was terrible at his job. It's very good that he's gone.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't put all the blame on him for botching the Sue negotiations. You saw that press conference after the Dallas playoff loss, the fake crying. He was way out the door.
Oh,
I
yeah,
never
for
expected
sure.
that guy
oh,
to,
for sure.
to ever, even when they drafted him. I never thought he, once we found out he was weird,
yeah.
I knew he was never going to sign a second contract in Detroit. It wasn't going to happen.
Sure.
And so, yeah, I would probably push him more into the idea that they should have drafted Aaron Donald, especially, like, you would think, although Bob Quinn's been doing his own things in these last couple drafts, he would have taken Aaron Donald because you can't have too many defensive linemen, you know. So, yeah, like, to put tons more blame on Luan and really take it off of Mayhew, no, that's not fair either. They're both culpable in this situation. So, yeah, I mean, I basically agree with you.
I do think the missing element here is, you know, we're not naming coaches more because there was a big misuse that really led to...
They do what they do.
Yeah, and that's fine. You know, like Ebron got a lot of...
Like some bad coaches.
Well, he got a lot of blame for drops, and he got the label for drops because he had a label for drops in college.
North Carolina, the Lions.
He didn't make a significant amount of drops
in
the NFL.
Crucial drops. But it was. You forget about?
But it was.
That?
That's the thing. Is it was at the worst times. He was not a big. He didn't show up in the big games to make the big. He made drops when he really couldn't make drops, and so he did. He did.
Don't sugarcoat his time here just because he's a Pro Bowler now.
No, I don't even like. My next step is that, or my next point here is that he didn't help his case any because he's a very immature person.
Yeah, very mercurial, everything.
And so
he still takes shots at people in Detroit.
Yeah. I mean, look, he is,
and he's already gotten the last laugh.
Right, and he can. There's so many people that could walk away, and just be like, "Hey, I don't, you know, they don't need to do this." But then there's a couple of guys that maturity levels are just terrible, and they just decide that they need to feel better about themselves to keep taking shots at fans, and that's fine. I mean, if that's what you need to move on with your day, but you know, he dug himself his own hole in a lot of ways as well.
Well. Hopefully we don't have too many Ebron questions left. But sadly, with the slow development rate of tight ends, we're probably going to have a lot more coming over the next year. So we'll see.
Yeah.
We're going to get out of the debate section. We're going to move over to scheme. Jared's got a question. Do you see the Lions leading the league in two and three tight end personnel groupings? And do you have a prediction as to the percentage of overall snaps that Hockenson, James, and Amendola play?
So I've actually been researching this for an article that I'm going to try and put out in the next couple of days. You know, there's been a lot of talk about the Lions using 12 personnel, so one running back, two tight ends, and so I wanted to see like how much that's actually used in the NFL. So I went back and I looked up some statistics, and the most
34%,
a little bit more. It's at 40, and so 40% was the most. Actually, 34% is the overall. Yes, it was only
really?
I believe that was it was 34 or 36. Was the most it was used last year. The year
Which
before
is a lot. That's a third of the time.
Right. And the year before it was 40, and then I think there were three other teams that used it in the low 30s. And then if you go beyond that, it was about the same. You still ended up having a team that was around 40%. So if you look at it over the last 3 years, the maximum, the highest that the teams have used 12 personnel is about 40%. And so if the Lions are going to lead the league, they're probably going to use two tight end sets around 40% of the time. That's what trends basically tell us, right? And so if they're using these two guys 40% of the time, you now have 60% of the time remaining to divvy up. And if you say, all right, 20% of that's going to go to each guy, now you've got Hockenson on the field for 60% of snaps, James on the field for 60% of snaps, and Amendola on the field for 20% of snaps. So maybe Amendola sneaks out a little bit more than 20%, but to think that Hockenson and James each get around 60% of the snaps, I think is pretty realistic. And if they do, that and they are on the field together 40% of the time, I think that works. I think you can get all of those guys by splitting it up. Now, obviously, there's going to be more unique things that they do, and Amendola will find ways to get on, and there'll be situations where they use guys differently. But rough numbers, that's what it makes sense to me. 40% together, and then 60-60-20, and away you go.
Maurice asks, do you think we'll see Stafford take a couple teammates to his Georgia estate to get some chemistry in with his new offense playbook like he used to do with Nate and Calvin back in the day?
I don't think he's headed to Georgia with his wife's situation. No. But I would not be surprised to see that happen here. More often, we're starting to see players train in this area. There's an NFL training facility here in Rochester that NFL draft hopefuls go to. And some of the players... Like,
who runs it?
I'm blanking on his name right now. But Deshaun Hand and Tracy Walker, they both moved back to Michigan ahead of time. And they are both training there when they're not doing their OTA. So they're training in Rochester together right now. And there's these facilities that are around. There's other avenues where people, they find other spots that they can go to. I do think that you will start to see teammates connect more and more as we progress through these last couple weeks of OTAs and over the summer heading into training camp. I don't think Stafford's going to be leaving Michigan, though, anytime soon.
Zach Myers asks, in addition to the offensive coordinator, what have been some of the changes in coaching staff since 2018 and potential impact? Are there any indicators besides wins we can look to as measurement of how Patricia and staff are growing or not in year two of his regime?
So other than Bevel, they hired quarterback coach Sean Ryan and running back coach Kyle Kasky. Other than that, they retained their receivers coach, their tight end coach, and their offensive line coach and assistant offensive line coach. So we're going to have Bevel and a couple of backfield guys as new coaches. As far as how will they impact, it's really kind of too early to tell. But if you look at their history, Sean Ryan has a history of coaching some of the bigger guys. Like, he's coached Eli Manning, and then he was part of Deshaun Watson. Kyle Kasky was coming from Cincinnati, and he made Joe Mixon, the AFC's leading rusher last year.
That's a sore spot for Lions fans too.
But I'm saying Kasky was his coach, and so their impact is hopefully going to be positive. Unfortunately, it's a little too early to really say on that. Now, as far as Patricia, realistically, how we're going to judge him will ultimately be on wins and losses. But I think, if you want to go beyond that, there's a lot of different things that you can do to see. Like, there's a lot of statistical categories that you can examine. From an offensive standpoint, there's going to be a lot of rough roads. But from a defensive standpoint, we should see some improvement.
Stafford Defender asks, what can we realistically expect from the offense in year one? With an entirely new system and playbook, recent history from other teams tells me it's okay to have high expectations, perhaps. Pressure is definitely going to be on the offense to perform this year.
Mm-hmm. History tells us that it takes about 8 weeks when you have a new offensive coordinator before you really start seeing results. There are 16, maybe there's 15, 15 or 16 teams in the NFL that all have new offensive coordinators.
Some of them are going to come out gangbusters.
And some of them are not. And so it's what's going to happen with this crew?
Well, it's
going to be hard to tell.
Sadly,
right?
We kind of know.
Well, no. I mean, because
Stafford doesn't react well to new systems. I don't know why.
Well, he's had four of them in his career. Yeah, you know what I mean? So
he's now a 10-year man,
right,
who can play this position backwards and forwards. Mm-hmm. It shouldn't be that big of an adjustment for him anymore.
I agree, and maybe it won't be. You know what I mean?
I hope so.
Before, you would expect him to struggle, and he did. Now you don't expect him to struggle, so we'll see. Maybe he won't. Hopefully he won't. And as far as the other guys, you're retaining your offensive line coach, which is going to help immensely. And so you're not just your offensive line coach, but your assistant offensive line coach and Hank Fraley as well. So that's going to help that offensive line cohesion. And from an offensive standpoint, that's a big part of the carryover that can help you in moving forward. But this offense, from what we're gathering, is going to be an offense that wants to establish the run, control the clock, and basically just hold the ball and score when they need to, and they're not going to be trying to like run up the lights on the scoreboard. They're just going to try and be efficient and controlling. And so that's not going to be like super wow like we saw like with the Rams like last year, right? But this seems to be what they want to do. Now, can it be different? Sure. Can they do more? Absolutely. It's hard to know what to expect at this point in the offseason.
Brian Bamberg asks, it's often said players make the biggest jump in level of play from first to second year. Along those lines, how do you see the defense looking in the second year of Patricia's hybrid system? Who do you think will emerge as defensive playmakers?
The big thing is, with any defense, is you want to look at the guys up the middle of the defense, right? And Harrison is your anchor. He's now been in the system for, a while now. 10 weeks, right, or 9 weeks, or whatever it was. And now he's coming into year two. He's solid. He even showed how solid he was. Behind him is Jared Davis, who will now have been in the system calling audibles and stuff. This should be an improvement with him. Diggs essentially moved back into that free safety role about halfway through the end of last year as well. And if it's not him, you've got Tracy Walker, who had some experience there as well. So you've got experience down the middle of the field, and that's going to help. You also have experience up front with A'shaun Robinson, Deshaun Hand, and now you're bringing Flowers over, who again knows the system, backed up by Aquara, who again spent a year starting in this system. So up front, you've got nice experience. Down the middle, you've got nice experience. And then outside of that, they're building guys that can help make their scheme more multiple. Christian Jones is going to be in his second year starting. Tabai, they drafted in the second round to help make this multiplicity. You're again second year in the system for Devin Kennard, second year in the system for Darius Slay, Tavon Wilson, Tracy Walker. And you're really only adding new starters to cornerback two and nickel corner. And Justin Coleman played in this system previously when he was in his time with the Pats. So he's not totally unfamiliar with it as well. Really, the only raw position is going to be cornerback two. So you've got experience across the board, which is going to help. And then you have also added players that allow you to switch between 3-3, 3-4, and 4-3 with ease by adding four defensive linemen, by having four linebackers, by having six defensive backs with three corners and three safeties. All those things add into a defense that really is what Patricia is building towards. And this defense, even this is a top 10 defense right now. They have the potential to be even higher.
Well, that leads us into Nick Coscarelli's question. What is the true ceiling of the of this defense? Can they have the number one defense in the NFL like the Bears last year? Don't count on it.
I think number one's really going to be challenging. I mean, it's hard to be able to pinpoint any defense going into the season that would be number one. I think they're top 10 right now. I think they have the potential to be a top five if they do the things that they want. The difficult part is that you have to remember that in its basic sense, this team, this defense is still a defense that doesn't want to allow the big play, is willing to give up yards as long as they don't give up points. So they're going to not finish statistically high in some categories, but they're going to be really high in others. So will they end up with the number one ranking? I doubt that. But I do think when all things are said and done, they're probably going to be in the top 10 in a lot of the right areas that, you know, lead to wins.
James Schobert asks, can you explain the functions of a Will linebacker, the Jack linebacker, and the Mike linebacker within the Lions defense? Thanks. Love the content.
So the Mike is the anchor of the defense. He's the guy who sits in the middle. He lives in between the nose tackle and the three technique, or depending when as those two guys shift, he shifts as well. He doesn't line up he doesn't line up over the center. He lines up kind of like in that A gap in between the center and the right guard. Now the Will linebacker is he plays at the same depth level. So they drop back at the same level, which is not something that we're used to seeing in 4-3 schemes in the past. In 4-3 schemes, the Will linebacker plays a little bit closer to the line and he plays outside of the tackle box. In this scheme, the Will plays more like an inside Will in a 3-4, which means that he plays at the same depth as the Mike, and he lines up inside of the tackle box. So he lives basically in between, like at the three technique almost, in between the left tackle and guard. He lines up between the defensive end and the nose tackle. So these two guys basically play a role that's very similar, and that both of them can drop, both of them can blitz, and they both play in the gaps of the defensive lineman in front of them. So when you hear Will, it's not really like a Will that were like a DeAndre Levy Will. This is more of like an inside Will in a 3-4 system. So they run a very similar situation. The big difference is that the Mike is responsible for a little bit more coverage on the ground. And the Will just isn't, he doesn't gather as much responsibility. He doesn't have as much to hold as far as like, you know, his assignments. But the Will and the Mike are almost identical in the types of things that they do. Now, the Jack is completely different because the Jack plays outside of the tackle box on the opposite side of the defensive end. And they will rush more often than not. But they do have to be capable of dropping back into coverage. But mostly, the Jack is basically like a stand-up pass-rushing linebacker. So, Kennard is your Jack, Jared Davis is your Mike, Christian Jones is your Will, and Tavai can play all three of those spots. And it's going to be interesting to see how they utilize Tavai, because if they move Tavai into the Mike, they can shift Jared Davis to the Will or the Jack, and they can really do a lot of different things that can make this multiple, and they can actually even add a fourth linebacker on at times. And that will that making this defense even more multiple.
All right, more listener questions. Nick Coscarelli once again, with the Patrick Peterson suspension, could the Lions ask for a better matchup for their offense to go into the season? I looked at the Cardinals roster. I don't see many difference makers in the secondary.
Yeah, they have a guy that they just signed out of free agency who just had a down year, Alford. And then they drafted Byron Murphy out of Washington. And he's a good player and he has his upside. But in his first NFL game, if he's starting and they're asking him to cover Kenny Golladay, that's a tough ask. He's going to give up a lot of height and a lot of speed. And so I do think that this is a pretty massive advantage with the Cardinals not having Peterson in that first game.
You know what I'm going to say? It was a tough ask to ask Sam Darnold to start his first game on Monday Night Football on the road at Ford Field, and look what happened. But we'll see. Yeah, and hopefully this pays huge dividends for the Lions. But there's always that fear.
Sure. I mean, we could say that about a lot of tough ass, right?
Sure.
In this specific situation, the path to a W in week one gets a little easier with Patrick Peterson not on the field.
We got to get through these last two, I think. Carl Maurer, how does Patrick Peterson's suspension affect a potential trade?
I don't think they'll make one. If they did,
it'll take weeks before they can, before they could consummate.
Well, the price would go down significantly. I don't think it puts them in a position where they're going to want to trade him either way, though.
All right, Steven Misilowski. Jamie Collins signing with the Pats, would he have been an upgrade over Christian Jones or Jelani Tavai?
I don't think he would have been. You know, I think you can add, there's room or a little bit of room to add a depth guy. I don't even know if there is, though. He would be taking Reeves Maben's spot. Him and Patricia never really got along. And everything I've heard is, one of the reasons Collins was shipped out of New England was because him and Patricia did not work well together, and Patricia didn't think he had a use for him anymore. So that's, you know, Patricia's not in New England anymore, and now all of a sudden Jamie Collins is back there. So I think it's everything I've heard, this lines up that he never would have really ended up here.
All right. It seems that the rest of the questions we have are evergreen, so we'll be able to answer them next week. We are running low on time for this week, so let's go to the shout-outs.
Yeah, we've got another review. This is from Dan Anderson, who's asked us some questions before on the podcast. He's a long-time listener here, so we appreciate him taking the time to give us a nice review. And so we've got to give him a shout-out.
Yeah, thanks, Dan. Thanks for writing in. Thanks for giving us the 5-star review. Hey, anybody else who wants to give us one, we'd appreciate it.
We've had a lot of people ask how to give reviews. Right now, only iTunes really takes them. So if you don't use iTunes, unfortunately...
Don't worry, just keep listening.
Yeah.
We still love it regardless.
Exactly.
And thank you to everybody who listens, whether it be on iTunes, Stitcher, Podbean, the Google Play, or the Google Podcast app, whatever you're listening to. Thank you, as always. Thank you for listening to me as my health is deteriorating live over this microphone. And we will see you all next week. And until that time... Let's go, Lions.